Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Cuban-born writer Reinaldo Arenas with our guests Anne Tashi Slater and Peter Johnson. Arenas was born in the Cuban countryside, where he spent a lot of his time in nature, fostering his creativity and imagination. He originally sympathized with Fidel Castro's revolution, but quickly became disillusioned when he gained power. Due to his open homosexuality and anti-Castro themes in his writing, Arenas was persecuted and spent many years in some of the worst prisons in Cuba. He became an exile, a ghost, as he says. Arenas escaped to the United States during the Mariel boat lift of 1980, eventually settling in New York City. Sadly, he became a victim of the AIDS epidemic, contracting the disease and ultimately ending his life after finishing his memoir, Before Night Falls. Remarkably, this entire time, Arenas never stopped writing. Anne and Peter are interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
Anne, Peter, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes. Yeah. Pleasure.
I'm excited to get into it, but first, I guess, tell me a little bit about yourselves and what you've been up to this past pandemic.
I am here in Tokyo, and we've had various states of emergency, and it's been a little slower with the vaccine rollout, and so we're still kind of in the middle of it. So it's been a quiet time. Externally, I think internally, creatively, it's been very interesting, and I've been working on a lot of different projects. So I recently finished a memoir, and I'm Tibetan American, and I grew up in New Jersey and California, and I grew up basically trying to ignore my Tibetan heritage because I really wanted to fit in, and my mother wanted us to fit in. She's Tibetan from Darjeeling. And then after college, I really felt that I wanted to explore that missing part of me. I felt like it was missing. And so I went to Darjeeling, where my family is, and spent some time with my grandmother and started hearing her stories and so on. And this started me on the track of exploring my heritage. And so this memoir is basically about a journey I took to India with my mother, and to reconnect with her, to reconnect with my Tibetan roots. It's about displacement, it's about exile, it's about integration, about the immigrant's journey, her journey to America, and then my journey back to the country she left in order to find myself. And it's basically looking at what home is and how second generation children like me find our identity in this, you know, intersection between the traditional and modern worlds. So that's some of what I've been working on, and a lot of what I write about in my other writing as well.
Great, thanks for sharing that. How about yourself, Peter?
Well, basically the pandemic, I returned from Girona in Catalonia in late February as it was beginning to roll across Europe. And left for the country, the up country house in the northern end of the Hudson Valley in New York, and have basically remained here. It's enabled me to spend more time with a nonprofit. I'm the vice president of Princeton in Latin America, which is a postgraduate fellowship program that links up graduates from US, Canadian, UK, Australian universities to work a year or two in Latin America with partner organizations, basically in socioeconomic development, public health, human rights, civil rights, things like that. We've been around for about 20 years. And the pandemic has enabled us to do a lot of rethinking of the program and the type of way that we can operate. We usually have 25, 35 fellows in the field, and now we have had to work remotely, which is a real challenge.
Yeah, I hear you. The rethinking part, though, is kind of, one for me at least, one of the good things I hope that comes out of kind of reimagining things. And so it's interesting. You both, what you're doing is very much related to, I think, you know, Rinaldo in his life. And you're speaking of the feelings of exile and immigrating and trying to connect back to your roots or find your roots. So I wonder, could you both give me a little bit of, tell me a little bit of how you first met Rinaldo in person, and or did you meet him in his writing first? Sort of tell me that experience. Peter, if you want to start this one.
Well, it was a foiled attempt. My first trip to Cuba was in 1979, shortly after it became legal with the Treasury Department and the administration in Washington. The objective was multifaceted in terms of the trip, but a critical thing was to meet major writers, and Rinaldo Arenas obviously was. He was published first in 1967 with his novel Celestino Antes del Alba, which is a tremendous novel. Actually, it's his second. His first one wasn't published. He had disappeared from sight, from intellectual sight. And I was with a colleague from the Spanish department at Princeton, and we spent quite a bit of effort to uncover, to meet him. And time after time, it was a roadblock. Everyone said, such a writer doesn't exist. Yet this was a writer, Cuban writer, who received a Cuban literary prize and was published by the Union of Writers. And it was only when I had a conversation with Maria Lestayo, who was head of acquisitions at the National Library of Cuba, and she took me aside in the hallway and said, oh, yes, he does very much exist. He used to work here. He's now marginalized, in so many words. And then a longer conversation we had with Jose Rodriguez Feo, who is a member of Harvard's class of 43 and was a graduate student at Princeton, class of 48. And he remained in Cuba because he believed in the revolution, even though he came from a very wealthy background of planters. And he explained it a bit more, what the reality was. And of course, at this period, Cuba was beginning to be less attractive to intellectual life, to freedom of thought and expression. Remember, 79. So they'd already gone through the 60s and the difficulties there. That was the first encounter. The real Rinaldo appeared, of course, with Marielle in 1980, the boat lift. And he soon left Miami and arrived in New York. And so I met him soon after that arrival.
Wow, yeah. And what, I guess maybe we should give a little bit of a, maybe a brief bio of Rinaldo and his life. And so like you said, in 1979, he had already kind of been, I don't know if ostracized is the right word, or even more severe than that from the intellectual community.
I think brushed out of existence. Not unlike the Soviets did, you simply brushed the person out of the photograph.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yet he was known among others in Cuba. And when Anne and I were in Cuba for 5 weeks in the early 80s, and subsequently, he certainly was well known among people and much, much sought after because his books were all banned.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, Anne, I just read your piece. I think it was in the Paris Review of recounting that trip. And I found it fascinating how they, you know, people wanted to talk about him, but also didn't really want to because they couldn't. That was the kind of sense I got. So could you tell me a little bit about that trip? And you had met him prior to that trip, right?
Yes, yeah. I actually, I met Rinaldo through Peter, actually, and it's one of my favorite stories, actually, and I remember it really well, even though it was many, many years ago now. And I majored in comparative literature at Princeton. I did French and Latin American literature, and I was I stopped by one beautiful fall afternoon at Firestone Library to say hello to Peter. And I had been thinking about what I was going to write my thesis on because I was a senior. And Peter asked me, and he said, you know, what are you going to write on? And I said, I was thinking about Reinaldo Arenas. And he said, oh, well, I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. And so I said, well, that, you know, and so this is what happened. And so Peter introduced us, and I'll never forget, because I was young, you know, I must have been like 22, and I went the next day to meet Reinaldo in Peter's office, and I was nervous because I didn't know how he was going to look at this kind of eager young, you know, admirer who was a college student, and he's the great writer. And also, as you know from reading some of his work, you know, there's quite a lot of violence and brutality in his work. And I didn't know, like, was he going to be this like, really kind of like like violent or brutal kind of person, and it was going to be this really arduous day or what, right, was yeah. it like? And I'll never forget, he was the kindest, most gentle person you could ever meet. And he was so soft-spoken. And I went into Peter's office, and they were there, and Reinaldo stood up, and he took my hand like you would in, you know, like if you were going to kiss someone's hand. He took my hand and he said, encantado. He says, you know, I'm enchanted to meet you. And I was like, oh, I was hugely relieved. like, and he was so easy to talk to, and he was so forthright, and he was very humble, and he was very present. And so the three of us went to an apple orchard to kind of spend the day chatting, and I interviewed him, I'll never forget, Reinaldo was so happy to be out of Manhattan. You know, he kept saying, oh, un día, you know, en el campo, you know, a day in the countryside. And so he was so happy, you know, because he came from the countryside in Cuba. And I think it gave him a feeling of home. And so we spent that day. And then when I remember saying goodbye to him, it was actually the last time I saw him. And we were sitting, there's a little train at Princeton called the Dinky that goes back and forth between campus and the main train line. And we were sitting, the three of us, on the bench there waiting for the train. And I was asking him all my last minute questions. And I'm like, well, what about this? And what do you think this means, you know, in the story? And he was, you know, answering all of them, and twilight was falling. And then we said goodbye. And that was when I met him. And so then when Peter and I went to, yes, when we went to Cuba, there was really, there's a huge, huge admiration for Reinaldo in Cuba. And it was very clear. And so I ended up writing my senior thesis on him, and about his work and the process of translating his work. And so I included the interview, which is the one that subsequently was published by The New Yorker, right, in the page turner. And my translations of three stories from a collection that he wrote called Termina el Desfile. And it's a collection of semi-autobiographical stories that chronicle this period from the triumph of the revolution in 1959 to 1980, when, as Peter said, he left in the Mariel Exodus. And so I translated three of those stories, one of which is La Vieja Rosa, which is Old Rosa, which was the one that was later published by Grove in a novel, in a book called Old Rosa, a novel in two stories. And so I have very vivid memories of being deep in the bowels of very far-flung libraries on the Princeton campus, trying to find the names of certain birds. And what the equivalent was in English of these birds or this kind of tree. Because of course I didn't want to just say a tree. It had to be that kind of tree. And so I remember that very well.
I was going to ask about that process of translating. That has always been fascinating to me. And especially with the writer who you so much admire, I wonder did you kind of get closer to his writing, or did you kind of through translate it, understand it in a different way, or find little nuances during that process?
I did. It's a really interesting thing to do translation like that, because you enter into that writer's world. And when I was young, I always wanted to be a writer, and I used to, when I was very young, I would take, like, I had a little manual typewriter that belonged to my mother, and I would type out passages by writers who I admired, right, on this typewriter. And translation is like yet another step further, right, where that, because you're actually, like, you know, you're entering into this world. And of course, it's not just equivalences, you know, that you can look up and say this means this or that means that, but where you're really trying to understand the vision of the writer, and that perhaps whatever it is in Spanish will not be best translated in the literal way, but will be best translated in a way that fits with whatever his larger vision is. And so for me, it was a wonderful training for me too, as a writer, to get in, to understand how he wrote, right? To see how he wrote, to see how he put things together, and to have to do this, you know, going back and forth in my own mind. And of course, because at the end of the day, you're creating a text in English. Right. It shouldn't, like, read as a translation, right? And so somehow, you know, translating it with a capital T, you know, actually, so it stands as a text in English.
Yeah, it's a good point about training as a writer too, like, just practice, basically.
Yeah, it gave me a wonderful training in attention to language. Because you have to be, like, so focused in this micro way on each word. Well, okay, so here's this word, and here are, you know, you kind of become a synonym finder in a way, like you're, like, you know, or thesaurus, you know, and like shuffling through all these different possibilities and the nuances of them. And that has all over all these years, as I myself have become a writer, has served me well.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And what, I guess, is a good chance to maybe get into Arenas's writing a little deeper. What about his writing captivated you first?
I think probably it's the language. He comes from the campo, Jíbaro, in a sense, and he makes that transition into Havana after the revolution, works in the National Library filled with books. You know, no one works that hard, so you have a lot of time to read, goes to the University of Havana. Someone like that, before the revolution, probably never would have had those points of access. So you see that developing, and he expands in terms of what he reads. And that's what I found intriguing in the first few of his books. And then El Central, which is a long poem, but really based upon his incarceration in a re-education camp that was all, of course, controlled by the government, and was the place they sent all types of deviants, but especially homosexuals. And that poem, I think, coupled with the novels, opens up a whole other perspective of how he thought. He thought about the realities in which he lived. And then I think it's important to note that three of his works subsequent to his first one were written in Cuba and published illegally outside of Cuba. So those are my real introduction of reading editions of works that one deals with Mexico and addresses the efforts of a Dominican priest to break with the orthodoxy of the church and promote independence of the country, independence of the Creoles, independence of thought, which of course was against the Catholic Church at the time. And that was, I think, is a very important work to understand how he sets the universality of problems And he sets it in an 18th century, early 19th century context in Mexico. And you think 15 years before that, he was a campesino. So we have to give the revolution credit for education, for the literacy campaigns, things like that. But it seriously went offline when the censorship arrives. So I'll pass it on to Anne.
For me, you know, Reynaldo, I remember him telling me when we were speaking that he said he wrote in a, and he said in a some, he said, let's call it torrential. He says torrential way. And you can see this, like, for example, in Old Rosa, it's basically over 40 pages. That's one paragraph, right? There are no paragraph breaks at all. And that's not the only story of his that's like that. And so he just has this breathless kind of passionate, like, outpouring of what he's writing about. And I actually thought if it's suitable now, I might read a short part from that. Yeah. So
that's, yeah, I was just thumbing through trying to find one. Some you said remind me of that. So yeah, that's a great idea.
What I thought I would do, I'll read just the beginning of my translation of La Vieja Rosa, and we can get a feeling for it. In the end, she went out to the yard, almost enveloped in flames, leaned against the tamarind tree that no longer flowered, and began to cry in such a way that the tears seemed never to have begun, but to have been there always, flooding her eyes, producing that creaking noise, like the noise of the house at the moment when the flames made the strongest post totter, and the flashing frame came down in an enormous crackling that pierced the night like a volley of fireworks. She went on crying, and her face, shrouded in a reddish halo, looked at times like the face of a little girl lost in the middle of one of those storms that only occur in hallucinatory illustrations accompanying stories of witches and other phantasmagorias, which she had never read. But now and then, when the flames exploded almost before her eyes, singeing her lashes, her face lit up with all the features that time had undertaken to etch there. Then it could be seen clearly that this was an old woman, and had one of the neighbors passed by, he would have confirmed that this woman could be none other than old Rosa. The brands, still flaming, were leaping into the air and tumbling down over the towering weeds in the yard. The fire was feeding upon itself, rising up all around in a sudden surge and threatening to strike the woman, making her breathing more difficult every moment. She was surrounded by the flames, and had she screamed, it is possible that no one would have heard her cry, indistinguishable in the snapping of the weeds and the explosion of the trees, which were even then dissolving in the air, transformed into evanescent swirls of ash. She was surrounded by fire, and in other times terrified, she might have said, or at least might have imagined, "My God, this is hell." And even if she had felt lost, she might have started to pray. But now she was not praying, not calling out, not even seeing the fire that was already leaping impatiently up to her skirt. She was seeing, and this is true, other realities even more important to her. And it goes on for 40 plus more pages in one paragraph like that. So,
wow.
And what's interesting too is he said, you know, that his stories in a way were some, not all of them, but let's say this one, were meant to be a kind of narration or a story told of a moment. And so this story, Old Rosa, begins and ends with that scene that I just read to you, right? And so the end is takes that up again. And so, and then in between, we read about her past and present, and it all comes together at the moment when she's basically burning up, right, in her house. And so it somehow conveys this feeling that you're actually getting this one moment, even though, of course, it's spread out, you know, through the text. And so one of the things that is most compelling to me, and this, you know, came out in talking with him as well, is that for Reynaldo, and I was talking earlier about his vision, he did not distinguish between the external world and the world of the imagination or dreams in terms of real and unreal. So often we think, oh, dreams are not real or the imagination's not real, but for him, it was all real, right? And you can see that, for example, there's a short story of his called Con los ojos cerrados, with my eyes closed. And it's an 8-year-old boy who's walking to school, and he comes across various unpleasant and scary things. And some of the events occur in the external world and some of them in this 8-year-old boy's imagination. And so the first, this is one of the stories that I translated in my thesis, on when he first is walking along and he has his eyes open, he sees, for example, a cat, right? A cat that's been run over in the street. And he says, "Poor thing," I thought, "I'm sure some machine ran over him. He was a big yellow cat that certainly had no desire to die." And then the boy closes his eyes and he says, "With your eyes closed, you see lots of things, even better than if you kept them open." And then he says, with his eyes closed, he's walking. He says, "Again, I came across, I tripped over the cat by the curb, but this time it jumped up and took off running. And I laughed so much when I saw it disappear, defiant, its bristling spine seeming to give off sparks." And so the imagination was so important to him. And he said when we were speaking that, you know, with this, he called it this extraordinary weapon that imagination is, that no one can ever take away, right? That you always have that. And it's how he survived a lot of the brutality of his childhood in the campo as an only child with a very difficult family situation. And then, of course, again, all the horrors that he endured later. And so it was a way for him to fight and survive the tyranny of his family, the tyranny of the state, and other tyrannies that he encountered.
That's a great point. And that, like you said, that sense of, you know, reality and imagination kind of mixing, or really there is no difference, I think comes out in his writing as well. I think he does a good job of giving his writing a sense of a very real sort of direct storytelling kind of, but then also has that, those elements of magic, I guess, which is those things that, you know, yeah, like you said, keep us going when it seems impossible, or, you know, but you can always imagine something else, right? Or like, or something different than your situation that will kind of help you get out of your situation or just survive your situation. And of course, he had the great talent and dedication to writing to then, you know, put those stories out. But one thing that has been so impressive to me is his dedication to writing. We mentioned he had to smuggle out his first manuscripts and or hid them, you know, in his aunt's roof. You know, that's one part I remember. Or he would, you know, friends who he would lend them to, but then they became not friends or became informers, and so he couldn't really trust anyone, but kept on writing the whole time. And I'm curious if he ever spoke about his love of writing, or sort of what writing provided him as far as sustenance goes, I think. So I'm just curious if you ever had conversations with him about that.
I think in some ways over the decade that I knew him, I could perhaps summarize those conversations as ones of moral drama. And in a sense, well beyond the medieval passion play of what is moral and immoral and that, but his moral dramas were ones that linked all aspects, the physical, the tangible, the intangible. And he, I think through experience, was able to then articulate them in very succinct ways. So it's, when you consider the period he began to be a writer, and that was the age of the boom in Latin American literature, where magical realism reigned. And he's not part of that at all. He's able to capture the essence of these moral dramas and place them in different types of contexts that I think the reader is able to read. And then when you reread it, you come back, you're a different person. And again, the text speaks to you once again in how you have evolved in your understanding of the complexities of politics and repression and freedom and the sustenance that comes from relationships with other people. So that's in a sense how I I see what his aim was. And he was very consistent in my sense of his reading over time and in the conversations with him.
Yeah, I was just looking through the interview here for a quote where he's talking about the writing process, right, for him. He says that he's talking about this moment, right, this moment in writing, he said, where your characters start to live on their own and you no longer have to live for them. And what a marvelous moment that is. And he the process for him, and going back to what you said about the manuscripts that he rewrote and so on, like Otra Vez al Mar, which is Farewell to the Sea, is 500 pages. And he wrote it three times, right? Because they took it away the first time, they took it away the second time. And each time he just wrote the whole book again. And finally, it was smuggled out. And he just, you know, speaking, you know, to Peter, what you're saying here as well, you know, that Reinaldo, you know, the thing, his process, you know, he was very human. And what I mean by that is that his writing was grounded in human emotions, in his experiences. It wasn't diatribe. It wasn't like, you know, political kind of, that was not his first thing. It was just contained, as it were, as part of what he was writing. It just came forth, you know. Where so this is one reason too. I think, you know, we've spoken about, people ask, why has he endured, right? So you see some writers who don't, right, or you know, and maybe people don't the works don't endure, but he was able to write about, because you can say, well, okay, how many people can relate to an old woman on a farm, you know, in the Cuban countryside and her son and so on. But it was, for him, his writing is always connected to very universal themes that he accessed through the very, very personal, right, the personal telling of things that he himself had experienced or that he himself had felt. And he wasn't, you know, going back to the question of process, what's interesting is that, you know, you see like people like, oh, you know, you have to, like, if you're going to be a writer, you have to like sit in your chair every day for 10 hours. And, you know, when he was talking to me, he was very funny too. And he had a great sense of humor. And he goes, I won't say that I write every day. He says, because I don't, right? And he's like, right. So and he said, you know, I write, or, you know, I go to the gym, or he said, but my characters are always with me. And said, I'm always with them. I'm thinking about them. And so so he was always in the process, even if he wasn't necessarily in his chair, right? Literally.
Yeah. Right. Even if a writer's looking out their window, they're writing or something, like that. Like they're always thinking and always, getting to know the characters, and then those characters reveal more about themselves the longer you spend time with them. So fascinating that he always spends time with these characters like that.
I should probably interject here. An important element to understand his writing is to look at his manuscripts. And Princeton University holds all of his works that are known to exist. We began collaborating with him in the early 80s and through until his death, of course. And one, they're organized, you can look up online and search there. It comes out, I think, at least, it's 29 archival boxes. So there's a great deal there that you can see from version to version how he works, as well as correspondence that deals with his writing and progress reports and, I mean, personal correspondence that he wrote to his mother and to other people that we have gathered copies of. So this is an important resource to enable people to study him as a writer, but also as an advocate of universal rights, of freedom of expression.
Yeah, because that's, like you said earlier, Peter, the revolution was good in some regards, as far as literacy programs and whatnot. But then once they started to censor, and you know, you could only write about good things about the revolution, right? And I wondered, you know, and he talks about it a little bit in Before Night Falls, but it kind of broke his spirit at times. I'm so fascinated and impressed, I guess, of how he was able to maintain throughout it all. And then eventually he did, like we said, get out to the US. And I guess maybe now's a good time to ask about what it was like for him to adjust to life in the States. I haven't gotten there in the book yet, but from what I understand about his stories, he first went to Miami, and then later to New York City, maybe some other places in between. But I'm curious what that experience was like for him personally, if you have any insights into that. And then also, if not, if and how it impacted his writing at all, sort of that, that's a obviously giant life change, and in very trying circumstances. You know, he didn't immigrate necessarily, you know, he was exiled and had no choice really. I'm just curious about those, how it changed him as a person and as a writer.
I guess let me just quickly run through, as I recall, the conversations with him. As soon as we learned he was on the Mariel Flotilla, I put out through networks in Miami, you know, we have to talk to him. And so that worked. And within a relatively short time, he left Miami. And as he said to me, I left those people in Cuba and they're still in Miami. And I'm not part of that. So he came to New York. He's fascinated with New York, the museums, the street life. It was, of course, a brutal shock to come from a society with great scarcity to one where you walk into a library and you can basically access whatever you want to access. But the reality was he had to earn a living. And a lot of other people that came out with Mariel got mediocre jobs in different places and so forth. But he wanted to be the writer. So one thing we sat down very quickly was with the problem of the exile, is having the works that exist canceled out. And the way we did that is, along with Tom Colci, who became his literary agent, I know that if you have a text and there are subsequent editions, the earlier edition is no longer economically viable. So what we proceeded to do is reissue his works with corrections and declared them authorized by the author editions. So that was designed specifically to kill the market that was pirated. So that brought in income because they were being published by major publishers in Spain. And with his adoption in textbooks and literature classes and all that, of course, royalties help. I think that was an important measure. Also, for the legitimacy of him as a writer, these editions then carry a note that the original manuscript of this is at Princeton University. And that, I think, made a big difference. His adjustment in New York City, he lived in Hell's Kitchen, which at the time was not fashionable. Now, of course, it's been gentrified. I won't go into that, but it was a walk-up apartment. It was very modest. And he adjusted, like many immigrants in New York City, you adjust to the realities and you take advantage of the city. He came down to Princeton with some frequency. He loved being in a bucolic setting. He loved the swimming pool. The campus has two swimming pools. And I think that helped him. At a certain point, Humberto Padilla comes out of Cuba. His wife had already been out. They settled in Princeton. He became involved involved in the journal she was editing, Linden Lane, which was the street he lived on. He had many disagreements with Padilla, who saw himself as a great writer, which of course he isn't. And then the Mariel group formed their own journal, and he became involved in that, called Mariel Writing. And our conversations, well, I mean, as he said, you know, a lot of these people never had the chance that I did of working in the National Library. They were marginalized. They were younger than he. They were marginalized in Cuba, and they want to be writers, but they don't have enough background to really be good writers. So that's my sense of his life in New York, which was not easy, economically tough. He, of course, did receive invitations. He was able to speak in different universities. He was enormously generous with students and taking questions and being around after formal lectures and that. But still, living on the margin in a city like New York is tough.
There's also, in addition to that, it was indeed very difficult for him, and that he thought that he would be welcomed when he came to the States. And it, one of the most poignant and sad things about his story is that he finally, after so much suffering in Cuba and so many attempts to escape, finally made it out. And he was shunned by the Cuban exile community. And he was, as well as by leftists, because the leftists supported Castro. And so he found himself in this no man's land, but where he, as I say, thought he'd be welcomed with open arms, and nobody wanted to you know, see him. And he thought that, so, you know, going into exile, he says in Before Night Falls, in his memoir, that, quote, right, he says, "In exile, one is nothing but a ghost. I ceased to exist when I went into exile." And I think that was very much, you know, and being Reynaldo, he still found joy in life, and he still was able to, through imagination and through friends that he some friends he did have. But he said that, like, for example, his Mexican publisher told him he shouldn't have left. His publisher in Uruguay said that he should have stayed, and, you know, he could have worked it out in Cuba and so on. And so, and then as Peter says, you know, he was living in this Hell's Kitchen walk-up. And when I interviewed him, he had just moved out of his previous one, where he said the ceiling had fallen in and they hadn't fixed it. And so all the rain and snow came into his apartment, and he said, and damaged all of his papers. And so he left that apartment. And then the next not nice one that he was in, they still hadn't connected the telephone, right? This was 1983, and he had no phone. Right. And he said he had been waiting a month for them to come and connect it. And so here he had all this success, and he was so admired, and he put being published by, you know, big publishers in Spain and so on, but really living in penury and marginalized.
Yeah, let me add to this, is it was around this time in the early 80s. Mario Vargas Llosa was in New York, and came down, stayed with me in Princeton for a few days. And he said, you know, "I really would like to meet Reynaldo Arenas." And I said, "Well, you know, let me see if he can come down." So he took the train down. And I remember bringing him, Mario was at home, and bringing him over. And we sat in the living room. I was there for about 5-10 minutes at the most. And it was as if they had known each other since childhood, the way that conversation began, as equals. And, you know, it proceeded. And I thought, well, they can talk about writing, and I'll step out, and they'll have that liberty. Later that evening, Albert and Sarah Hirschman at the Institute for Advanced Study invited Mario for a cocktail party. And I said, "Well, Reynaldo." And they said, "Of course, bring Reynaldo." At that time, Carlos Fuentes was living in Princeton. And so I arrived with Rinaldo and Mario at the Hirschmans. And just parenthetically, Albert Hirschman was one of the writers of the Marshall Plan. So he's a major economist and philosopher. And we come in, and I knew Carlos Fuentes. And so I introduced Carlos to Rinaldo. And it was this really arrogant response of Carlos, "Oh, Arenas." And within a second, he found a way to get away from the two of us. And I contrast that with Mario Vargas Llosa's reception and how much, and going back from the party to drop Rinaldo at the train, the two were, you know, in deep conversation in the car, just like Anne and Rinaldo. So, you know, they're writers and they're writers. And these are two writers that were eminently human and shared a great deal in common about the importance of writing and not letting that unduly influence how you relate to people.
Yeah, well said. I am curious, Anne, because you mentioned talking about your memoir that you said just finished, or is it out yet already?
No, I recently finished.
Mm-hmm. Recently finished, yeah. But it seemed, you seemed to mention very similar themes that come up in Arenas's memoir. So I'm wondering if you had that in mind at all as you were writing yours. It's just themes of exile, and I love that you mentioned connecting with your grandmother and how important Reynaldo's grandmother was in his life, especially his early life, and all those stories she would tell about the stars and nature and, you know, all of that. So I'm wondering if you've found any parallels in your own writing of your own memoir that you saw in his?
That's a great question. It was many years ago that I met Rinaldo and that I did the work of the translation. It was not forefront in my mind, of course, when I was working on my memoir. However, what was interesting is as I was preparing for this podcast and I was thinking about my memoir and I was thinking about Rinaldo's work, I'm like, oh, I thought that's like, that's quite interesting, because, and part of it I think is that, of course, you know, everything that one does as an artist, you know, so everything that I've done as a writer, all the writing I've done over the years and the work I've done with the translation and so on is all part of, it's all in there, you know, and it's part of your subconscious, and my subconscious, even if it's not consciously in my mind. And these themes of displacement and exile and these journeys, you know, that we take to other countries, unfortunately, is probably never going to go away, right? I mean, and so in Reynaldo's time, it was a vital and very pressing topic, and today it is. And I think that it's been very interesting for me to look into it, both for myself as I say, as a second generation child, and then for my mother. You know, she left, she was the first Tibetan to come to the States to study medicine, and she went to Columbia, to medical school at Columbia, and settled in the States and never looked back. She has no nostalgia about like the old country or, you know, any inclination at all to go back. And then the question, you know, one of the things that I faced growing up, because I grew up in basically suburban New Jersey and California, and at that time there were really no Asian American kids that I can remember at all. And so I really stood out. And so my mother's efforts, and which, you know, I mean, she really tried to let us, you know, have us feel that we fit in, but of course we look so different, you know, and so the camouflage could never be completely successful. And so I think that this question, you know, where we look for where is home, and it's one of the, as I say, the really poignant and sad things about Reynaldo's story is that he never felt that he found it, right? He never felt that there was anywhere that he belonged, right? And I would say if there's anywhere that he did feel at home, it was in his creative world and in his imagination. And that's where he could live, That's where he could live, you know? And so he says in the interview that I did with him, I remember asking him, I said, you know, do you like living? Do you want to continue living in New York? And he said, well,
bueno, yo realmente no sé. Yo francamente, como nací en Cuba y viví allí, pues creo que debería de vivir allí si no fuera porque la realidad me condena a no vivir allí. Toda persona que vive fuera de su contexto siempre es un poco un fantasma, porque yo estoy aquí, pero a veces recuerdo una persona que camina por aquellas calles, que está allá, y esa misma persona soy yo. Entonces ya a veces no sé realmente si estoy aquí o estoy allá, ¿no? Y a veces...
Since I was born in Cuba and I lived there, I would like to live there if reality did not condemn me to live here, right? And he said, every person who lives outside his context is always a bit of a ghost, right? Because I'm here, but I remember a person who was there, and that person is me. And so I'm in this in-between, in this limbo. And for him, that was never going to end, right? And so the themes that I have written about, you know, and about dialogue, you know, dialogue across generations, across borders, relating to our cultures of origin, you know, as I say, it's all there, it's all still, it's, and it's just different. Obviously everyone has their own experience of it and their own story of it. And I don't think it even means that you have to cross borders. I mean, in Reynaldo's case, of course he did. In my mother's case, she did. In my case, I did, meaning I went in the reverse direction. <It's> like, but they're also, I think of it as internal borders. You know, there's this internal journeying that we do. And that's what Reynaldo was doing. That's what he was doing. And he had this tremendous fortitude, right? And what you were saying earlier about what kept him going and how did he keep on keeping. For part of the time that he was imprisoned, he was in solitary confinement in a cell where he couldn't even stand up, right? And he was in the most horrific conditions. And again, he said, you know, he said that it's his imagination, right? It's his imagination that saved him. And so I think that imagination is something that allows us to undertake, and this is one of the things I look at in my memoir, it allows us to undertake physical journeys that we need to take or want to take. And if we cannot take them for some reason, it allows us to take them in our imagination, and we can be saved in that way as well.
Wow, I love that. As you're saying that too, it kind of made me think like, this past year obviously is not so, not the same thing as Reynaldo Reynoso' story, but I know myself, I relied on my imagination a lot. It's just kind of, I live alone. So I was, you know, alone a lot. So I was thinking about things and I would just kind of run through scenarios in my head. And it made me think like, I wonder what, how do you think Reynaldo would be engaging with our current world and, with the pandemic, of course, but then also, I mean, well, also speaking of pandemics, I mean, he had AIDS, right? And eventually committed suicide. He already didn't live through an epidemic, but how do you think he would be engaged? Do you think he'd still be writing today? What sort of things would he be writing about, do you think?
I think just in brief, he would have been horrified at the looming authoritarianism with the advent of Trump.
Yeah. That's a great point.
He mystified how the American public could not understand that type of rhetoric.
Right, because he had already seen it, right? And lived through it. Yeah.
Exactly. I think also he would have just kept doing what he had always done. And he would have kept creating, he would have kept writing, he would have kept being the completely authentic and genuine person and artist that he was. And his memoir, which he was of course extremely unwell, and he dictated right into cassette tapes.
Right.
But yeah. He finished it days before he died. I think, you know, I mean, he was, and he was just driven, I mean, in the good sense of the word. And I'm sure that he would have kept on writing. He would have, you know, it was just for him like breathing.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, I know, Peter, you saw him just before he died, right?
The final week of his life, he called and said, this is it. So I took the train and picked up all the manuscripts, correspondence, basically cleaned off the shelves. His bookcase looked like a pharmacy, endless pills. Remember, this is 1990, so there's still a lot of experimental drugs being tried for the pandemic among that community. And we had a tearful embrace because we knew this was goodbye. And I mean, he lives through his writing, of course. And I'm pleased that, you know, Princeton had the foresight about his genius to make sure that that collection is in a setting that cannot be intervened by the state.
That is great. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that he said in an interview with Columbia University lecturer Perla Rosenzweig, and it was his last interview, and I found it so moving. And he said to her, he said, perhaps a future reader of mine will say how these people suffered, what a world they had to live in, how sorry we feel for them. And when I read his memoir, and I've read it a couple of times, I felt all over again. I thought, I just really had that sense of, I hope people will know that, you know, and that people will know how much he suffered and how much not just him, but his friends and all the people who suffered at that time. And now in these other regimes, it's not, as we said, just a local situation. And that's one reason his writing endures, but that he just had this tremendous, as I said, fortitude and commitment. And his commitment, as we say, was to, of course, to imagination and also in a larger sense to freedom. That was really what he was about. And at the end of the interview that I did with him, I asked him, I said, you know, do you think a writer has a duty to himself and to society? And he said that
si es un escritor, sea un verdadero escritor, sea una persona, un oportunista que lo que quiere es vivir bien de acuerdo con el gobierno de turno, siempre va a estar por la libertad, porque no puede haber escritor si no hay libertad, sencillamente. Y si está por la libertad, pues de hecho no puede estar por ningún sistema totalitario. Así que de hecho, el deber del escritor es estar bien y defender la libertad. O sea, escribir bien y defender la libertad. Uh-huh. Si defiende la libertad, pues ya tiene un compromiso. Sí. El mejor compromiso que es.
The writer has a fundamental responsibility to write well or to write the best that he can, because if he doesn't, he's not a writer. And he said that if someone is a true writer, not an opportunist who wants to be in favor with the government of the day, that person is always going to be for freedom. He said, because the truth is that without freedom, the writer cannot exist. So the duty of the writer is to write well and to champion freedom. And that was Reynaldo.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, that's couldn't have summed that up better myself. we're getting close to wrapping this up. Was there anything else that you wanted to cover? Any other stories you wanted to tell before we close this out?
I guess I would just urge those who will listen to this in the future to go to their libraries and check out the books. There was a span of, unfortunately, more than a decade, I think, that he was not republished. His works went out of print because of conflicts with the multiple heirs, literary executors and heirs. But now there are critical editions that are being issued, mainly from Spain. So he is accessible, and I think very rewarding as a writer.
Yeah, I agree. Well, yeah, thank you both for being here. I had a great conversation. Like I said, I'm not quite done before nightfall, so I'm looking forward to finishing that up. But yeah, I also had a great time learning about him and his inspiring, honestly, his story, and then his commitment to writing too is astounding to me. So again, thank you, Anne. Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. It was really, it's such an honor and a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk about Reinaldo. And to you know, he lives on. And thanks to you, we can help that to, you know, help that to be true, you know, that his work will live on and that people will know who he was and who he and what his writing is. And I thank you for this opportunity to talk about him.
Yeah, thank you. I think the museum is doing a real service internationally for these types of conversations. The only disconcerting thing was Anne saying several times, so many years ago. I calculated it is about 40, and it doesn't seem like that to me. I mean, many, many ways, he is a writer who, both in his writing, but also personally, leaves an indelible mark on your mind. And I think on your soul, too, because he did stand for that type of liberty that all people, or many people at least, have that as part of their quest in life.
Yeah, and he never swerved from that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The series will return in August. If you would like to learn more about American writers, their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, come check it out in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening. And to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.